Hello, everyone, and welcome to the YJBM Science News Podcast, where we discuss the most recent science news from across the Yale community. My name is Sam. I'm a first-year MPH student in the Department of Health Policy.
And I am Mara, a second-year PhD student in the Department of Microbiology.
I know it's been a little while since you've heard from us. We took a little break. There's been some travel on Mara's end. I had COVID, unfortunately. But we are back and better than ever, and we're excited to share some more news with you. So, Mara, what do you have for us today?
So, we'll be starting out with a study from our own Yale's Department of Immunology, collaboration between a few really big labs, and what they were looking into is how we can use currently available medications against respiratory viruses.
Okay, so can we start by outlining the problem with respiratory viruses?
Yeah, of course. So, first of all, thinking about respiratory viruses, we all think about SARS-CoV-2, the causative agent of COVID-19, a virus that we all became very intimately familiar with, unfortunately. But there are also other microbes that can cause respiratory infections, such as, say, influenza viruses. For the purpose of the study, they used highly pathogenic H1N1 virus of flu, and also stuff like respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, which you've also been hearing about quite a lot this season. What unites all of these viruses is that they generally establish infection in the upper respiratory tract, which, if untreated or if a person for some reason cannot defend against it, will then spread into lower respiratory tract, causing some pretty nasty infections. So consequently, because of that, people infected with those viruses will display respiratory symptoms, just such as cough, and also, it allows them to transmit between individuals through aerosol droplets. So because the virus itself resides in the respiratory tract, somebody coughs, virus gets out, gets into another person. It makes them very efficient for transmission. And while the whole COVID pandemic is officially over, those viruses still cause millions of cases worldwide. And if we're talking about, for example, flu, that accounts for hundreds of thousands of deaths annually. And it can also disproportionately affect some countries that may have less developed medical healthcare systems. So definitely we need to be looking for different ways to fight against them.
Oh, I agree. So how did researchers approach this problem?
Well, they started by looking into this unique environment of the respiratory tract because it's a very particular type of cells. And in order to complete the infection, virus really, really needs to establish itself there. So the benefits of focusing on this area, there are really two. First of all, of course, we can reduce the infection of the host and really protect the individual from the infection and from complications of infection if it goes to lower respiratory tract. But another thing is that by reducing the number of virus particles in the upper respiratory tract, we can also reduce the amount of virus that can be transmitted, therefore just reducing overall burden. In addition, they try to focus on antiviral therapies that, instead of just killing the virus directly, what they do is they activate natural immune responses of those cells. And they looked at it in terms of what we call ISGs, or interferon-stimulating genes. When expressed, the genes just activate certain parts of an innate immune system, and then cascades can form, and this way our cells can fight off the virus. Now, in terms of how they approached it experimentally, it can be divided into three clear parts. First of all, they wanted to measure the impact of their chosen therapies on the ISG expression in upper respiratory tract of mice, and also to see how does that indeed protect against flu and COVID. Another set of experiments is that they wanted to see the transmission protection, and for that they used the model of hamsters, because those are usually your model animals for testing COVID transmission. So they infected them with COVID, and they saw how this kind of therapy can reduce the transmission of COVID. And the third set of experiments they did is they also tested healthy human volunteers, but what they did, they just saw if there was actually activation of those immune cascades in the upper respiratory tract when exposed to therapy. Now, I keep mentioning like therapy, antiviral. What I'm talking about is a thing that most of you will probably know. So probably everybody knows Neosporin, like a thing you can find in all drugstore. Well, it contains neomycin, which is an antiviral that they were using in this therapy. Now, when we were talking about the third experiment with healthy human volunteers, they literally just applied Neosporin gel to their noses, and they measured the IgG expression. And indeed, in all those three sets of experiments, they did see that, first of all, neomycin increases the IgG expression, it includes protection against flu and COVID, and it reduces transmission of coronavirus between hamsters. And of course, it increases the IgG expression in healthy human volunteers as well.
That's so interesting. What is the significance of these findings?
Well, besides biological significance from research perspective, you can see that it's really interesting how such widespread and pretty cheap therapy can be used for protection against respiratory infections. So I would say the most exciting thing here, at least for me, is that we're looking at an idea that can result in spreading those therapies to areas which may not have as well developed systems or like developing and delivering vaccines and different interventions. But since neomycin is pretty wide available, we can use those results to reduce the transmission of respiratory viruses in different areas.
That is very cool. Thank you for sharing.
Sam, tell us what's the next study about.
Yeah, a team from multiple schools, including Professor Zach Cooper from Yale School of Public Health and in the Department of Economics, conducted a study of antitrust enforcement in the U.S. hospital sector to see whether the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is taking enough enforcement action against hospital mergers annually.
Wait, so how did they test whether FTC antitrust enforcement is adequate?
So based on insurance claims data from three of the largest insurers in the U.S., those being Aetna, Humana, and United Healthcare, which the data was provided from the Healthcare Cost Institute, the team then analyzed mergers to see whether they led to price increases. Because the logic is that if the FTC is providing adequate enforcement, then the mergers that they do not challenge won't really affect competition and as a result won't really affect prices. So after identifying the mergers that led to price increases, the team then analyzed whether those bad mergers were ones that could have been identified as anti-competitive pre-merger. And this was done by flagging mergers with post-merger anti-competitive changes in the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index based on the 2010 horizontal merger guidelines, and by flagging mergers where the parties experienced increases of willingness to pay at or above 5%, which would indicate an increase in hospital markups and thus prices.
So what did they find out and what are the implications for the hospital market?
They found several things. To begin, they found that mergers that resulted in the largest price increases could have been predicted to do so beforehand based on the horizontal merger guidelines. Second of all, the FTC is not taking action against a significant number of hospital mergers that could have been predicted to violate the guidelines, which is leading to diminished competition and notable increase in prices. In fact, the sort of marquee finding for this study is that between 2002 and 2020, of the over 1,000 U.S. hospital mergers that occurred, based on FTC screening tools, 20% of the mergers that occurred could have been predicted to meaningfully deteriorate competition. And from 2010 to 2015, those types of mergers that were predictably anti-competitive resulted in price increases over 5%. And half of those mergers could have been challenged per FTC reporting requirements, effectively illustrating that there is under-enforcement of antitrust laws in the hospital sector. Lastly, mergers lead to price increases for outpatient services that are comparable to inpatient increases. And this is novel. This is a novel finding because typically this type of research has only been looking at inpatient increases.
I see. No, that's really interesting. I don't get to work much with like hospital policy or any kind of policy, really. But it impacts all aspects of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really interesting for me because I'm actually in a class with the professor from Yale who was on this study, and part of what I did for this class was write about antitrust enforcement and my belief that not only do we need to ramp that up, but also the FTC needs a larger budget in order to conduct all of this antitrust enforcement because they have, I believe the number was $136 million for antitrust enforcement in the entire United States. When I think, you know, we need just that and more just for the hospital sector.
Well, hopefully we'll see some meaningful change in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Mara, what is our next study about?
Well, we are coming back to talking about COVID, as I'm sure everybody's so eager to talk about. But even though we're talking about COVID therapies again, now we're talking about the focus on immunocompromised individuals.
Okay, so what is the current recommendation for immunocompromised individuals, and why do we need to change it?
Well, so the official, the most commonly prescribed antiviral for immunocompromised people, patients, is Paxlovid, which is FDA-approved, highly efficient antiviral. It's great. It saved so many lives during the pandemic. However, it does have a problem. So it has this antiviral component, which is great, amazing. But another component, which is needed for correct metabolism, because otherwise the active ingredient would not stay in the system. The additional component can negatively interact with some medications that immunocompromised patients take. For example, it can negatively interact with anti-rejection medications, like somebody who received organ transplants and are immunocompromised because of that, should probably not take Paxlovid, for they can still get COVID, as you can imagine. So some research needs to be done in that direction.
Okay, so what did the researchers do?
So sometime before I think this paper was published, they have identified a potential alternative. It's a compound that they call MPRO-61. It was originally identified through computational predictions and evaluation of currently FDA-approved compounds, which they then altered slightly to like fit the profile that they desired. Now, the mechanism of action of MPRO-61 is similar to that of Paxlovid in terms that it binds to one of the essential proteins of SARS-CoV-2, so it prevents the virus from making more copies of itself, which we call replication. So, like, essentially just can't make more viral particles, dies out. Now, for testing in humanized mice, which is what they did for this paper, they mostly used a combination of MPRO-61 and a current antiviral, which is also used for immunocompromised individuals, but it's just not as good as Paxlovid by itself. It's called molnupiravir. Please, sorry to all pharmacists who actually know how to pronounce that. And they found that this combined therapy, well, separately, those compounds are, they have some degree of protection, but not as good as Paxlovid. But when they're combined, it really efficiently protects the mice against infection. Just exactly what they were looking for.
So what are the next steps?
Well, they did test pharmacological properties of MPRO-61, and they did find that they didn't notice any off-target effects like the ones that Paxlovid would have, and it can be efficiently delivered and metabolized. However, just what it makes it now is that it is an excellent candidate for clinical trials. I do not know that it will be running clinical trials here or what the next steps will be, but it does have a lot of potential, it seems.
It's great. That's exciting to hear.
Okay, Sam, what is our final study of the day about?
So this study was prepared as a working paper of the National Bureau of Economic Research and was conducted in part by Professor Savinsky of Economics and of Management at Yale. In it, the researchers aim to develop an economic theory of mental health, which accounts for many economic consequences of mental illness, including income loss, costs of mental health treatment, diminished consumption and investment, and choice of jobs with, you know, lower levels of rigor. Professor Tsubinski calls it the first integrated model of macroeconomics and mental health, building on classic and modern psychiatric theories. And it emphasized the negative thinking, rumination, and reinforcement through behavior features of mental illness.
And how exactly was this research conducted?
So it was definitely a lot going through the paper, but from my understanding, first, the team demonstrated that mental illness affects a number of dimensions of the economy and personal finances, including consumption, savings, portfolio choice, and labor supply. They do this by quantifying the degree of negative thinking and its dependence on mental health using micro-level economic data from RAND's American Life panel to understand the extent of negative thinking on individuals with mental illness. Next, rumination is modeled as losing a portion of available time, and reinforcement through behavior is modeled via the treatment decisions of individuals experiencing mental illness. Following that, the model was quantified relative to three mental health states, those being healthy, mild illness, and serious illness, and the transition probabilities for the individuals who do and do not receive treatment were estimated. The model was validated by evaluating how it compared to non-targeted moments that describe the relation between mental health and economic outcomes.
I see. And what exactly did they find?
So the final bit of the study focused on the implications of the theory of mental illness. It found that the aggregate cost of mental illness was 1.7% of consumption annually. The average consumption equivalent cost of mental illness for individuals with serious mental illness is 15.6% and is 10.3% for those with mild illness. As for the implications of mental health policies, they sort of looked at three different ones. So first, they found that increasing availability of mental health treatment reduced mental illness by 3.1%, with welfare gains of full access to treatment being felt most by those who are mildly ill and do not have access to treatment in the benchmark economy. Secondly, in contrast, they found that the welfare benefit of reducing out-of-pocket costs is actually effectively zero, because the monetary costs of treatment are relatively low in the baseline economy, so lowered costs do not really lead to a reduction in mental illness. Additionally, they found that improving mental health in late adolescence and young adulthood improved the mental health of 25-year-olds, translating into an aggregate consumption equivalent gain of treatment in young adulthood of 1.7% annually. Finally, the researchers quantified the value of improving the efficacy of mental health treatment, which could be due to advances in therapy or antidepressant medication, and they found that the aggregate consumption equivalent gain of a, 10% more effective treatment is 0.7% or $78 billion annually. That's so much. The implications of mental illness, on the economy are crazy.
That's really interesting. It seems like a very wide-scale study as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Very thorough. And honestly, the summary that I provided does not, I don't think it provides an adequate flavor of just how much they touch on in the study. It's quite a long one.
Well, nevertheless, we're going to drop the link in the description, as we do with all studies featured here. This was Mara and Sam with YJBM Science News, and we will see you the week after next, because now we're doing bi-weekly.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. Bye.